Welcome to Teleforum, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of practice group Teleforum calls, become a Federalist Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Teleforum conference call. This afternoon's topic is titled, The Antitrust Failing Firm Defense in the Wake of COVID-19 Crisis. My name is Greg Walsh, and I am Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we are fortunate to have with us Mr. Greg Eastman, Mr. George L. Paul, and our moderator, Mr. Eric Grannon, a partner at White & Case, LLP, and former counsel to the AAG of the Department of Justice Antitrust Division. After our speakers give their opening remarks, we will go to audience Q&A. Thank you all for sharing with us today. Eric, the floor is yours.
Thank you. Again, welcome everyone to our panel on the antitrust failing firm defense in the wake of the COVID-19 crisis. Again, I'm Eric Grannon, a partner in the Washington, D.C. office of White & Case, where I specialize in antitrust. We've definitely got two well-known merger experts and specialists on our panel today. Greg Eastman is an economist and vice president at Cornerstone Research, based in its Washington, D.C. office. Greg got his undergraduate degree at the University of Kansas and his PhD at Harvard. Among other relevant experience, Greg served as the DOJ's testifying expert in a litigated merger challenge that turned on the failing firm defense, and that experience will be helpful in addressing our topic today. Our other panelist is my law partner, George Paul. George is also based in the Washington, D.C. office of White & Case, where he's practiced as an antitrust lawyer and merger specialist throughout his career, including working on some of the biggest merger clearances and challenges of the last two decades. George got his undergraduate degree at Mississippi State University and his law degree at Harvard. Greg and George are going to walk us through the details of what is known as the failing firm defense in antitrust merger analysis, which is likely to be a significant feature of antitrust enforcement for the rest of this year and beyond as companies struggle to survive the pandemic. Just as a brief backdrop, merger analysis is unique in antitrust law and separate from competitor agreements that are assessed under Section 1 of the Sherman Act or monopolization claims that are assessed under Section 2 of the Sherman Act. Mergers are assessed separately under the Clayton Act, where the relevant standard is whether the proposed merger would result in a substantial lessening of competition. And there are three quick points, to keep in mind for our discussion about mergers today. First, the Clayton Act standard of a substantial lessening of competition has been held to focus exclusively on consumer welfare, meaning will the proposed merger lower prices or improve products or services or innovation for consumers? Other economic considerations, such as job losses as a result of the merger, are not cognizable under the Clayton Act. The second point to keep in mind is that proposed mergers of a certain size must be notified to the federal antitrust agencies at the DOJ and FTC for clearance under the Hart-Scott-Rodino Act. If the agencies do not clear the proposed merger, the agencies can seek to enjoin the merger through a litigated court challenge. Now, the government also has the power to seek to undo consummated mergers, but the overwhelming majority of merger enforcement focuses on either clearing or challenging proposed mergers that have not been consummated, and that setting is our primary focus today. The third point is that proposed mergers are assessed under merger guidelines published by the federal antitrust agencies. For purposes of our discussion today, at a high level, those guidelines become especially rigorous if a proposed merger would reduce an industry from 4 to 3 independent players. And the guidelines generally will presumptively condemn a merger that would reduce an industry from 3 to 2 players. The failing firm defense comes into play when parties argue to the agencies that the reduction in the number of players from a proposed merger should not be deemed unlawful because the company to be acquired would exit the market in any event, due to the demise of the company, but for the merger. So with that backdrop, George, can you lead us off with a discussion of the elements required to establish the failing firm defense?
Sure, Eric, and thanks for that background. I'll kick it off, and here's what I'll do. I'll talk about the elements of the failing firm defense, and then maybe, Greg, you could talk a little bit about the agency's views of it and the true application of it. But from a legal standpoint, Eric set the tone exactly right. The Department of Justice and the Federal Trade Commission, as well as the state attorneys general, are tasked with reviewing mergers to ensure that they don't substantially lessen competition or tend to create a monopoly. And as Eric said, this is typically the case, can happen in transactions involving, say, two of the three largest players in an industry where entry is hard and you worry about a loss of competition. One way to think of it would be if the market was for just for cola and Coke and Pepsi merged, you might imagine that there could be some concerns about it. And that's fine. But what happens if the target company is at death's door and is so financially distressed that the merger that's been proposed is their only way to stay in the market and to keep their assets and products on the market? But the government of the Federal Trade Commission perhaps thinks that it would be bad for the two to merge because it created a monopoly. Well, there's an answer for that, and it's been around longer than even the Hart-Scott-Rodino Act. It's 90 years old, and it comes out of a Supreme Court case, International Shoe, from 1930. In that case, the failing firm defense was established, under which an anti-competitive merger can be permitted as an absolute defense to government action, where the failing firm otherwise would exit the market. The rationale is that consumers would be no worse off with the merger than they would have been if the merger were blocked, because the target wouldn't survive and would exit the market. So that at a minimum will keep more assets in the market and therefore no harm, no foul. The failing firm supposes that a transaction would have a redeeming quality. And when Eric referred to the consumer welfare standard, there is a general presumption oftentimes that transactions, while perhaps putting pressure on raising prices, typically generate some cognizable efficiencies that can occur. So maybe allowing these merger to monopoly is slightly better than would just than just allowing the company to disappear. That said, the agencies want to be careful in applying the failing firm defense to make sure that the failing firm is really failing. And to do that, this really has been a three-pronged test that's been established that is a bit ambiguous. So I'll say these are elements, but each one, there's a fair bit of discussion around what they mean and case law fighting over it. The first element is for a firm to be failing, it's got to be unable to meet its financial obligations going forward. That's pretty simple. It means, you know, if we're thinking in a bankruptcy sense, it means that the firm is insolvent, it has no net worth, or is on the brink of having to declare bankruptcy. If you're thinking in terms of equity, it would be the firm is unable to pay its debts that are due. It's got to be so depleted that the possibility of it coming back is very remote, and it faces the great possibility of just disappearing. The second element is one that has been created by the DOJ and the FTC, and is not case law created, and that is that the failing firm has to be unable to avail itself Chapter 11 of the Bankruptcy Code and reorganize. Typically, the antitrust agencies are going to look at the failing firm's business plans going forward, its projected revenues and its expenses, and vet whether or not they believe it would be possible for the company, rather than to exit, just to instead declare bankruptcy, reorganize, and come back into the market at a later time. And then finally, because the merger is presumed to be anti-competitive, we worry about the acquiring party gaining too much market share. And the final element addresses that, and it says that there can be no alternative, less anti-competitive buyer out there. And that question is there somebody else that we could allow to acquire the target's asset other than this guy who's going to become the monopolist? And that oftentimes trips buyers up because to satisfy this element, it's important that the failing firm have conducted a very vigorous search for other buyers and made bona fide efforts to make itself available and would be willing to accept any reasonable alternative out there. If these three elements are met, there really is no other buyer. The company can't survive and its failure is imminent. Then the merger will be allowed to proceed going forward. And that's easy to say, Greg. How easy is it to implement in real life?
Well, I think that it's hard to implement in real life. I think that one way to think about how do regulators really handle claims of failing firms? And I think that the regulators start with a position of no. They start with this idea that, you know, there really is a very high bar to have a failing firm defense because of what you said, which was that this is really an attempt and maybe even the last ditch attempt to get an otherwise anti-competitive merger through, right? So they start with this, that there is some sort of presumption of, you know, potential harm here, and they really, you know, justifiably don't want to pass that on. I think that beyond the sort of, you know, what you might call philosophical reason why you want to have a very high bar here, there's also a little bit of the sort of boy who cried wolf phenomena that. And that is that a number of, you know, firms have gone in and claimed, you know, that they're going to fail and they put forth a failing firm defense. And then the merger is blocked anyway because they haven't met one of the, you know, stringent criteria. And then those firms go on to live, you know, healthy and productive lives, or at least survive for a long period of time. And so that's, you know, has informed the agency's views of how they, you know, think about, you know, some of the requests that they get in terms of having this failing firm defense, and therefore makes it even more difficult to mount an affirmative defense, even when you have a legitimate case for it. And I think one, so you think about, well, where do these things, you know, falter? And one of the reasons, one of the ways they falter, in addition to the things you mentioned, George, was that oftentimes the merger is happening at a significant value. That is, the purchaser is paying a significant valuation for the so-called failing firm. And there's a question that, you know, gets derived from that. If this, you know, firm is really struggling and about to fail, imminently close to failure, why are you paying a large premium for it? Or why are you paying a substantial amount of money? And that oftentimes provides a little bit of a stumbling block and a little bit of a, you know, reason why, or a thing that you have to explain away in terms of talking to the agencies about it. Now, one of the things you mentioned was there could be some sort of cognizable efficiencies that could be gained or some synergy that could be gained for the fact that you're combining the assets. It could provide some value. So it's not necessarily, it doesn't have to be a deal breaker, but I think it's sort of an initial stumbling block for some people off the line. Right? Another go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Greg.
No, that's it. Go ahead.
Okay, well, thanks, Greg. I think that is very helpful background for the audience. George, can you walk us through a couple of examples of actual proposed mergers where the failing firm defense featured prominently?
Sure. And so, you know, we're focused on COVID now, and that's important because I think this economic crisis and the pandemic have put a tremendous pressure on companies, and we'll see this defense or iterations of it being played out more and more before the agencies and these transactions as, you know, white knights try to come in and save companies that are on the verge of failing. So the two examples I picked, one I picked from healthcare, and it's a hospital merger, and I think it's very relevant in the COVID setting today. And I think we could see a number of hospital failures going forward. And so you might see this defense play out. And the other is from the milk industry, but it's one that just played out in early 2020, which wasn't directly related to COVID, but it happened right as COVID was coming into the forefront. So let's start with Sutter Health, which is from about 20 years ago. So it's a bit dated, but the same conditions facing hospitals are relevant. This was a merger between number two and number three, the largest hospitals in San Francisco, Sutter Health and Summit. And as Eric rightly pointed out, 3-2 mergers between the large players like this are likely to raise concerns. And boy, this one did. Summit Health was the target here, and they believed and asserted they had a great possibility of failing. They had over $9 million in overdue bills. They couldn't obtain credit to help pay off the bills or invest in the business. And the fair market value of the liabilities was a lot more than any fair market value of their assets. So a pretty good candidate for a failing firm defense. Sutter Health was agreeing to buy it and said they would be able to invest and maintain the facility and improve and innovate and create new efficiencies and better healthcare for consumers. The government disagreed and sued to block. The California AG in particular argued that Summit Health was claiming a failing firm defense, but it was the result of their own mismanagement. And if they'd done a better job of taking care of their financial condition and taking care of getting accounts receivable collected immediately, they wouldn't be at this risk of failure, and that the court should not reward the past financial mismanagement of the company by permitting the defense to do it. And instead, the hospital should get new management and figure it out and come up with its own view. The court weighed the evidence and then declared that the merger would be permitted to go through and rejected California's objections and saying that, you know, it doesn't necessarily matter why you're in the bad position. It matters that you're in bad position. So we'll expect to see more of these kinds of arguments from particularly rural hospitals that have been really hard hit by COVID, I think, going forward. The second involves Dean Foods, which was the nation's largest dairy processor. They take the milk from the dairy farmers themselves and turn it into butter and milk and other products. They this industry has been hard hit for a number of reasons, including people just drink less milk than they used to. They went into bankruptcy with the possibility of trying to reorganize. At the same time, another large milk processor, Borden Dairy, was in bankruptcy. So you had two of the three largest milk processors in bankruptcy. At some point, the reorg just wasn't working out, and Dean Foods went on the market and shopped itself to a large number of buyers and ended up with two alternatives. One was Dairy Farmers of America. And they are a dairy farm cooperative that also runs milk processing. So the deal would be allegedly problematic, at least, from increasing concentration in that milk processing industry, which is important because we don't want farmers to be disadvantaged and get a fair price for their milk. The government really did a very nice job in this one, I think. The Department of Justice considered the financial condition of Dean Foods, its own ability to reorganize, and weighed that an acquisition by DFA against possible bondholders trying to reestablish and reorganize the company in some fashion. It consulted with the debtors in possession as well as the parties and others in the industry before concluding that it would permit DFA, Dairy Farmers of America, to buy Dean Foods out of bankruptcy and control those assets. But it did require some divestitures to address the hardest hit portions of the country where they felt concentration would be too high. And in so doing, they accepted a failing firm defense, but got the parties to agree to a settlement that would sort of ameliorate some of the potential harms that could come to consumers. And those other assets will go to another company eventually through a divestiture process. So those are two elements where it's really worked in industries that really hit pocketbooks for average Americans who've seen it played out. And I think we'll see more of those going forward.
George, just a quick follow-up. That the kind of hybrid result that you described in the dairy example, is that something that you do you think we could see more of that going forward?
Yeah, I think you will. And you know, there's versions of failing firm that are less than failing, sometimes called a weakened firm defense, that a failing firm can kind of morph into. But I think you will see it. What you see is a real desire, usually on behalf of the agencies, to do the right thing. They recognize that this is an unusual situation and it's really hard. But as Greg alluded to, they're skeptical and they don't want consumers to suffer, particularly, you know, parents that are trying to get milk for their kids and farmers that are trying to sell milk. And this is sort of an elegant way of saying, we get it, but since those assets are staying in the market, we think there's a couple of problems that we'd like for you to address. And if you'll do that, we'll bless the deal and we won't have to go to court. And the party, DFA, was more than happy or more than willing to accept that deal in exchange for the certainty of being able to move forward on the assets it did acquire.
Okay, so, you know, in explaining some of the tough elements that parties have to meet, you've now given us some examples where parties, despite those high hurdles, have been successful in establishing a defense or at least some version of it. Greg, can you share some examples of unsuccessful assertions of the defense and offer any observations on how they might have gone differently?
Yes, I can. And so one example is the Department of Justice blocking the Energy Solutions and WCS merger. Again, I was a testifying expert for the DOJ in that matter, so I'll try to make sure I stick with publicly related information. But this was a proposed merger between the two providers of nuclear waste disposal, and therefore it was a 2-to-1 merger, a merger to monopoly. And so that, you know, that raised, you know, presumptive harm with respect to that. And so the parties disputed some of that. And so there was a little bit of a dispute related to that. But they also put forth the failing firm defense because WCS was in a particular situation where, you know, they had, you know, some arguments they could make with respect to the failing firm. And one of those being that this was, you know, getting and implementing and constructing and permitting a nuclear waste disposal facility was a very long and expensive process. And so they had a almost 2-decade history of losses all the way through. And they had projections of future losses, you know, at least within the near term. And so that, you know, put forth, you know, and coupled with all the, you know, the pressures that go along with that length of losses, does suggest that this company was struggling and was losing money over a significant period of time. Offsetting that to some extent, and one of the places where they got in a little bit of dispute was that they were making, you know, statements to regulators, statements to customers that they were going to be okay, and they had enough money and they could, you know, continue to operate. And I think that sort of tension came up in the litigation and provided tension in the litigation. It also provides a lesson for today's environment, which is that, you know, there's sort of a potential catch-22 for people to keep in mind, like in advising companies and thinking about, you know, talking to companies, right? And that is, you know, in the middle of a crisis, you really have to tell your employees, your suppliers, your customers that you're going to be okay, you're going to survive, things are going to work out okay, because you can't get caught in sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy towards failure. So you need to make public statements. On the flip side, you may be struggling. One needs to think about how that would play in the future if some company were going to go in and put forth a failing firm defense. And so having some, you know, internal analysis and some distinction on how you play off that tension, I think, is going to be important. So thinking about, like, how, for example, are you going to characterize, you know, second quarter 2020 results, which for a lot of firms are going to be very, very bad, you know, how they, you know, characterize that publicly, how they characterize that internally may be important in terms of pushing this going forward. One of the other things that was a stumbling block with respect to the WCS Energy Solutions, and the judge really, like, this was sort of the deciding factor in the judge's mind, was, you know, did they perform an adequate shop process? And one, you know, I think that sort of sometimes boiled down to sort of this key tension that happens, which is that management tried to find the best value for WCS. And they were focused on maximizing the value of the sale from WCS. And they had ran a shop process that landed, you know, that existed over a period of time. They, for an earlier period of time, they did a, you know, fairly extensive shop process, and they got a number of offers for like sort of partial investments or evaluations that they didn't find that they were that happy with. So they stopped, didn't sell the company, then started up again, started asking some more people at a later point in time after more losses, and doing it again. And then, you know, they got a high, very high offer from somebody, the, you know, Energy Solutions. And then they sort of didn't really redo the shop process as fully as they could. And then, and in fact, signed an agreement saying that, you know, they wouldn't actually go and ask some of the other people, and they were precluded from talking and shopping it to other people. And the judge really picked up on that and said, you know, you didn't really try to go out and find a reasonable alternative offer above liquidation value. And so therefore you haven't satisfied the conditions for the appropriate shop process. And again, it highlights this tension between what you might think is like management's responsibility to maximize the value of the company, but with the requirements that if you're going to be involved in a transaction that could otherwise have anti-competitive harm, that there are other requirements that have to be taken into consideration. I think with the second, you know, case in the Autobot case, which is another case Cornerstone worked on, for full disclosure, but this was a challenge to what Eric had referred to earlier, which was an already consummated merger, and that the FTC was, you know, going in to try to unwind. And here, the sort of complication arose because of the both from the financial firming and financial failing, whether they're going to be imminent failure. In large part, that revolved around the idea that the firm, which was struggling over time, had implemented a turnaround plan, and that turnaround plan was beginning to be successful. So they, the firm itself was starting to show positive momentum and improving financial results. They had some internal stuff on, you know, it would have been, you know, they were going to become profitable, they were going to be okay, right? And that was sort of, in some sense, contradictory to this idea that they were in, facing imminent failure. Again, they also had issues with respect to the shop process and in the sense of whether or not did they get a deal in place with the person they wanted to do and then, you know, went through the motions for the shop process to try to, like, say they went through the shop process, but in fact, though, they really had signed the deal at the beginning or set up the deal in the beginning and sort of did the shop process, and where the agencies would really like to see the opposite of that, go through the whole shop process and then end up with the person you're going to merge with, you know, only as a last resort.
Interesting. Do you know, Greg, whether in the Energy Solutions case, after the merger was successfully blocked, what ultimately became of WCS?
WCS operated for on its own for a little while, and this was subsequently sold to another party, a party that had been identified as a potential buyer in the, you know, first set of acquisitions, or first set of the shop process.
Okay, so it did not actually just fail then. Interesting.
That's correct. It was subsequently sold to somebody else.
Okay, well, thanks for that. Let's shift a little bit more concretely to the current pandemic economy. George, has there been any express agency guidance or enforcement signals on how the failing firm defense will be viewed by enforcers since the pandemic started?
Yeah, I really think there has been here. Sometimes the guidance isn't as crystal clear as everyone likes it to be, but there's certainly writing on the wall here. Two examples that I can think of, it's really going back to the Dean Food case again. Where are we now? I think you're going to see a lot more back and forth and settlement from the government on cases that raise failing firm issues like the Dean Foods case. It's hard to tell how, you know, it's hard for the government to tell sometimes where a failing firm can be, but they clearly signal a willingness to work with the parties enter into a settlement that was speedy and put the problem behind them. So I think you'll typically see more of that. And I take that as a signal that that the government is certainly aware of the COVID-19 pandemic, and the antitrust authorities in particular understand that that will impact the ability of how firms compete and certainly will impact the assessment of mergers. It doesn't mean every time the defense is asserted it'll work, but I think it means the government's certainly paying attention. The other signal is that, but they're only going to go so far. And the example that I'm thinking of there is playing out in real time as we speak. I don't know if you've seen the Journal today, but the online food delivery service Grubhub is sort of on the block. Today, I think the wind's blowing in favor of a UK firm called Just Eats possibly being a winning bidder. Tomorrow or the next day, it could swing back to Uber Eats, which is one of the other, along with Grubhub, large players in the online food delivery service. And I don't know about you, but I know that there's many like me. Sometimes when you're stuck in quarantine, you really just need a Popeye's chicken sandwich. And the way to make that happen is calling up Uber Eats or Grubhub. And we've seen this industry, which is a young industry, take on tremendous importance for people and families as we have been quarantined throughout the crisis here. And in lieu of having to go out and get the food, we've had it brought to us. And this industry has really blossomed. And I think people realize that it's an important part of way our lives are going to be for some time. So that's been introduced. But you know what? It's a new industry. And like many tech-related industries, nobody is making money yet. So I thought it was interesting, as Uber Eats is in the middle of this potential bidding war, or at least expressing interest in these Grubhub assets, that just after they announced their earnings, their CEO went on a podcast and said some pretty interesting things. He said, essentially, asserting not a failing firm defense, but really in a failing industry defense. He said, you know, no one's making money in this business. And a business has got to be sustainable. It's got to work for restaurants. It's got to work for the delivery guys. It's got to work for the it's got to work for Grubhub and Uber Eats and those of us too. So things are going to have to change. And he explicitly said, we'll listen to what the regulators have to say, but you know, there's got to be a way forward that this industry needs to survive and people have to make money. Laying the groundwork, I think, for Grubhub deal, and certainly saying that, you know, when an industry's not making money, that's a good basis for having a failing firm. Well, no sooner than 2 days later, the FTC responded, and Ian Connor, who's the top litigator at the FTC, is the director of the Bureau of Competition, put out a blog, just happened to be about the failing firm defense, and just happened to be on the Wednesday after the Uber CEO's remarks. I'm sure they weren't related. And he said, you know, we've heard this time and time again, that this firm is failing, the acquiring firm is failing, the whole industry is failing. And his response was, saying it doesn't make it so. And he went on to say that if you want the FTC to accept your argument of a failing firm, you better actually be failing, and you better be able to prove it. And it was part of his remarks that really were saying that the government is not going to relax the intensity of their scrutiny, and they're not going to be scared of bringing an enforcement action because of COVID-19 is making business hard on some people. So on the one hand, a carrot, a willingness from the DOJ to listen and consider these issues, and on the other hand, a stick from the FTC saying that as a tsunami of these cases probably start pouring in, you're not going to get away with not proving that you're really in bad financial condition. And you're going to have to do more than say that the industry's failing. So I thought that was super interesting. We'll see how the Grubhub deal works out, or if it does at all. But I thought those were some interesting tea leaves coming from the agency recently.
And to pick up on something you said earlier about the agencies kind of imposing their own elements that doesn't really come from the case law. In the DFA example that you gave, It sounds like, unlike the example you're talking about now with the online food delivery, there was what the enforcers might view as sort of an objective confirmation because of the ongoing bankruptcy proceeding. How dispositive do you think that was?
I think it was certainly an important part of it. You know, they clearly are saying, I think here, that, you know, if the acquired firm's going to go to nothing, if it's really going to exit the market and all the assets are going to be gone, not producing milk at all, then we absolutely have to keep those assets alive by allowing the merger to go forward. If you're going to continue to use those assets, though, and it could raise some competition issues, they're going to look for a middle ground to try to minimize any impact that could come out there. And that could be attacking the failing firm defense on the merits and the elements as you speak, or morphing it into a weakened firm defense that's something a little bit less, where it's given due consideration but isn't seen as a strict full-on defense to an anti-competitive merger.
Okay, Greg, let's switch to you. On the same topic, but with your lens as an economist, are there unique features of the pandemic economy and its after effects that you think parties may be able to invoke in establishing the failing firm defense or some weakened version of it?
I generally think that, you know, the pandemic itself, a pandemic, you know, in and of itself doesn't necessarily affect the, you know, your ability to, you know, make a failing firm defense or implement a failing firm defense. I think that it's really kind of a question of the economic effects of that. And you want to distinguish between, you know, having, quote, the pandemic portion and the sort of residual economic effects, right, which can be, you know, significant and large. And you have to, like, kind of push it down to that level to focus on the underlying economic issues related to that. And so to use the, you know, following up on the Grubhub type example, if you go over to the UK, so there was a pending merger in the UK with Amazon and Deliveroo, right, that sort of started before crisis and ended up after the crisis and in the sort of in a switch from way in the way things were going, the Amazon was permitted to complete its purchase for a minority stake in Deliveroo, right? And that was due, and you know, in part to this sort of unprecedented effects, you know, in the food, you know, industry in the UK, and the need to sort of keep these things in, you know, and sort of sometimes the recognized need to keep these things in the market. But there's this sort of more philosophical question about how you handle this question that George brought up, with is like your whole industry is being challenged, right? And how you think about this idea that the industry itself is under pressure, as opposed to, you know, normally when you read the horizontal merger guidelines about it, it's about the failing firm, right? It's about, like, it's much more focused on one firm and what's going to happen with that one firm, and much less focused on what's going to happen to the industry overall, right? And is the industry failing or not failing is not, in some sense, not a direct question that gets asked typically. It does say a lot about, I think you think it to take it into consideration, because it says a lot about whether or not you think the assets of the firm will exit or not, right? So in an industry that's failing, if one firm fails, nobody else really wants, it's easier to make the case that the assets will exit the industry, because there's no point in keeping those assets within the industry, because the industry, if it's failing, it may be in part because it has an excess amount of firms in there, excess amount of assets in it, right? On the flip side of some of these things, another thing to keep into mind, that even if the, and something that may distinguish between the dairy example, the dairy farmers example, and the food takeout delivery example, which is the ease of entry back into the market. So again, this is not something that normally gets considered in a failing firm analysis directly, but is still important to think about in terms of the overall competitive effects. And something like the dairy example, like they have milk processing plants, there's, you know, there's a high cost of like having those things and operating something like that. Whereas in the food delivery, it's much more about having a platform and being able to create relationships with, you know, restaurants and customers and the entry cost may be different. And so how you think about the future competitive effects in the industry may in fact be different. And the other sort of, I think, fundamental question here really has to do with both the speed of which this, you know, economic crisis happened, right? And, you know, it really like hit everyone. It hit some people extraordinarily hard, extraordinarily quickly in a way that it's going to be hard for everyone to process and makes it hard to use, you know, historical comparables as sort of relevant comparables because of the speed at which it happened. And there's also this great uncertainty about how long is this actually going to last, right? We all agree that like, you know, starting from the middle of March through, you know, present time, things have been, you know, very difficult across wide swaths or the entire economy and extraordinarily difficult among certain swaths of the economy. But it's really hard to predict what's going to happen. Like, is this going to be for months? It's going to be years and that sort of thing. And a part of this overall, you know, predictive effects, you got to think about, well, what is going to happen? What is the process by which you go forward? If I'm going to have imminent failure, like, what's the time frame on that? And, you know, that's going to be in part on how bad the crisis continues to be.
That's interesting, Greg. So I've got kind of a reaction, and I want to run it by you to see if I'm, drawing the right conclusion. But I guess I hear you suggesting that in industries with, you know, hard assets like plants or airplanes, that kind of thing, that the agencies will not necessarily be as rigorous in those cases, or maybe I should flip it and say agencies will be even more skeptical in hearing a failing firm defense in an industry that doesn't have such hard assets like online-based companies, as opposed to ones where there are hard assets and entry can be viewed as a higher hurdle. Is that a generalization that you meant to suggest?
I don't think I meant to suggest it quite like that. I think the agencies have different sets of considerations to take into account with respect to the ability of the assets to exit. And that can make it more or less difficult for you to get a failing firm through, right? So you could actually think of examples where, because they have significant fixed assets, that it's unlikely that those assets would exit the industry, even if the firm were to fail, because somebody would pick those up in a bankruptcy or pick them up otherwise, and therefore that would make it hard for you to prevail on a failing firm defense.
Okay, thank you for that. I'm glad I asked for that sort of extra clarification. So, George, you did mention earlier some other sort of, we'll call them watered down versions of the failing firm defense, but so far our discussion has focused on the sort of literal failing firm defense. Can you give us some color around the other arguments that parties can make when they can't actually establish the literal failing firm defense?
Sure. There's really two major categories that fall short of failing firm, but that are related. The first is called the failing division defense, and that gets us to the notion that the whole company is not failing, but they have a distressed business line or set of assets that are products aren't viable anymore, they're having decreased profitability. And so they want to sell off a portion of that. And highlighting the justifications for why you're selling off a division like that, and that it is not a viable firm these days, may help to convince the agencies or at least the courts to approve the merger, where the overall business isn't at risk of imminent failure, but that potential part of that business is. Is something that has been accepted in the past by both the agencies and courts, and is, I think, something that you'll see as in a post-COVID world, firms look to prune the weaker divisions where they're not going to be able to invest sufficient capital so that they can put the capital to where they're most likely to be successful. And so I think you'll see more of this kind of defense. And the other really harkens to the T-Mobile Sprint deal, which certainly garnered a lot of attention. And that's the weakened firm of the flailing firm as opposed to failing firm. And the addition of that extra L makes a big difference. And this was another Supreme Court case. General Dynamics back in 1974 recognized the fact that when companies are merging, if the parties are able to show that the target firm is flailing and unlikely to be a constraint going forward, that the merger can be approved. The FTC and DOJ obviously look at this very narrowly, but if you can, typically turn the agencies around if you can prove that the current market shares that the firm has overstate its competitive significance due to the financial condition. And I think that's really where we're going to see things head. And why I think Sprint T-Mobile is such an interesting case. It's a little bit of what we'll find coming out of this crisis if we look back at 2008, is that a lot of companies are going to survive and come through. They haven't failed, but they're going to be weakened. I call it like the wounded wildebeest or the old wildebeest on the plain. Those are the ones that the tigers are going to and the lions are going to target first and try to go after and beat. And the question is that are they now so weakened that they may be the number three firm today, but if we really take a consumer welfare look at this and plan out, are they going to be a constraint on pricing going forward because they're so weak now they're inefficient? They can't afford to keep up with new technologies. They can't afford to update with efficient equipment. So in the next 3 or 4 years, which is beyond the term that you would look at for failing firm, they're not going to be a competitive constraint. They won't. A pharmaceutical company, for instance, that can invest in pipeline products in 5 years isn't going to be nearly as significant as its market shares today might suggest. That's the case that we saw with Sprint, and that was the point of disagreement. The DOJ, the FCC, and a majority of states believed that Sprint would be unlikely to be successful going forward as a competitor, and that by combining with T-Mobile, it could survive. And the industry was better off by replacing Sprint with Dish to come in as a divestiture buyer and step into its shoes and compete. The judge really felt that Sprint's weakened condition justified that, and the settlement made things even easier for the judge to figure out in the end. A coalition of states disagreed and felt that it was that we should have allowed Sprint the opportunity to try to reverse course and do it on its own, despite what its executives were saying, and force it to go out there and compete. I think you'll see that a lot going forward in these cases. In particular, there's been a rise of progressive antitrust out there that is challenging the use of the consumer welfare standard in merger review and looking for antitrust to take a broader view at what might be problematic beyond a specific price, innovation, quality measures in a specific market. And there, I think you'll see is that a rising tide of people that are questioning acquisitions on the basis of not wanting the lion to kill the wildebeest and get stronger as a result, and seek out predatory kinds of acquisitions that take out the weak and replace it with the strong. It's the opposite of what happened in 2008, where the government encouraged strong banks to acquire weak ones to keep them afloat. It's really the opposite. It's let the weak sort themselves out or try to combine amongst themselves, but do not let the big get bigger. And that will be the big area of debate going forward as to whether or not we pay attention to weakened firms' defenses or we seek to prevent bigness as a potentially bad thing.
Interesting. Okay. Well, thanks for that, George. Before we open it up for audience questions, I've got one final question for Greg. As we look ahead, if you could comment more on particular industries that you think might be more susceptible to failing firm defense arguments being made, not necessarily being successful, but being made. And then you also commented earlier about an acquisition that was reviewed in the UK, and I'm wondering whether there are interesting observations that you can offer about mergers that have to be cleared in multiple jurisdictions and how the failing firm defense might play out in one jurisdiction versus another.
Yes, I can talk about those things. I would view sort of like looking forward, I would think about, I'd probably say that there are four things to really kind of think about going forward. One, which would be what you just said, this whether or not there's going to be a continued divergence between how the UK and the EC look at mergers as opposed to with the US. In the UK and EC, they sort of have one additional element, which is what would happen to the sales of the exiting firm. And you have to think about, you know, for those additional sales, what happens and whether and what impact does that have on competition. And then and with greater uncertainty in the crisis, that just becomes a harder thing to kind of predict and think about. I think that's one thing to think about. I think you saw this in a recent, challenge to the PacBio-Illumina merger. It was challenged by both the FTC and the CMA. And that's this question about killer acquisitions. So one of the other sort of popular things that people have been talking about is this idea of killer acquisitions. And that is when, big incumbent buys a startup or a small, not yet really competitively significant player, but with the idea that at some point in the future it could have been competitively significant. And it's greater emphasis on this idea of, the dynamics of competition or the idea of network economics or network effects that could mean that in the future that a new entrant or a new competitor or relatively small competitor could actually grow into be sort of a real big, colossus of somebody. I think that's an interesting thing to look at. This idea of the populist, antitrust that George just mentioned, I think it's going to be going to play a big role here in the sense that you really have these, competing forces. Like in a crisis, there's a flight to safety among different levels. And sometimes, in the sort of real world economy, that the flight to safety really means the flight to bigness. And so the flight to the incumbent, the person the person who's big, who it's like too big to fail. And that's going to create, tension between the big incumbents and otherwise weakened firms. And how everyone handles that going forward, I think it's going to be very interesting. And the final thing I would raise with respect to this is really where are the deals? Where are the mergers? Right? It's a crisis. First of all, it's hard to think about having a deal today. Right. A lot of firms are like not fully operational themselves. So it's hard for them to just, keep their, own operations going, let alone buy someone else. You get this big divergence in some sense between, if you think of the overall stock market, there hasn't been a tremendous fall in stock market values, or it's at least recovered from the earlier fall. Right. And so that means the valuations for companies are high. At the same time, company, there's a crisis and you might not have as much, capital or cash to deal with stuff. And it makes it hard to think about deals at this point in time. So there may be a long delay before we get deals. It's just hard to know. But it's kind of interesting to see. First, we got to get to the deals and then we can worry about some of these other things.
Okay. Well, thank you, Greg. Greg Walsh, can you help us turn it over to see if we have any questions from the audience?
Yes, sir. Eric, it doesn't look like we have anybody lining up in the queue. Is there anything else you want to explore while we're waiting?
Well, I'll just take a moment to say, while we're giving the audience a chance to dial in *#, with any questions they might have, I want to thank Greg and George for their time and preparation in walking us through the failing firm defense today. And obviously thank all of our listeners. We hope you enjoyed the program and continue to look out for Federal Society programs that may be of interest.
Keep an eye out for emails announcing upcoming telephone calls by consulting the full schedule of our upcoming telephone calls on the Federal Society's website. Also available there are podcasts of previously recorded teleforums that you may have missed, as well as on iTunes and Spotify. I still don't see anybody in the question queue. Eric, is there?
Well, then I think I'll just again take this opportunity to say thanks to Greg Eastman and George Paul for their work today. And take care, everyone. Thanks for joining.
On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our speakers for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Teleform, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. For more information about the Federalist Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federalist Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.